Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. As always, it is great to have you here with us. Very special guest today, a guy that we had on Morning Joe for about a week or two when he had his book Evil Geniuses out. Kurt Anderson's going to be with us, and we're going to be talking about something I touched on last week, and that is the income disparity, how it continues to grow, and how it's been fueled by changes in the tax code over the past 30, 40 years, and fueled in large part to help the richest Americans, billionaires, to help multinational corporations completely avoid paying taxes. It's absolutely outrageous. But if you want to know how Democrats and Republicans alike work together to make this happen, and how even the Democratic bill that just got out of the House, why it's not even touching this issue of where income is taxed, but capital, massive capital, too often is not taxed at adequate rates. You can read Kurt Anderson's book, Evil Geniuses. It will explain a lot of the reasons why. And let's bring in Kurt right now to talk about that and so much more. Kurt, I want to start by talking with you because it's fascinating. I'm 58, so I'm probably, 5 years older than you, something like that, six, something like that. We grew up in slightly different generations. I graduated from high school in 81, so by the time I was graduating from high school, Reagan was on the rise, conservatism was on the rise, and I was part of that. I mean, I got swept up into that, sort of the reaction to 40 years of what we consider to be big government. I always said, if I graduated in 1971, I would have been a progressive, most likely. But talk about your background, because it fascinates me. Your dad was a Republican from Nebraska, right?
My dad and mom were both from Nebraska, both Republicans. And my dad was a labor lawyer on behalf of management in Omaha, Nebraska. So I was
an insurance defense lawyer. Okay, well, so go ahead.
There you go. So whatever the opposite of a red diaper baby is, I was. And I as a 12, 13-year-old, was like a teenage Republican and because you want to please mom and dad,
This is Hillary's story, by the way, in a sense.
Please. Yes, it was. And she was. In fact, I have Hillary in a novel of mine as a Goldwater girl in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But then 1968 came and I was 13, 14, and I changed my mind about everything and I left that. But yes, it was – and they were of a kind of Republican that no longer exists virtually.
Right.
They were not religious believers. They were, pro-abortion, pro-conservation, but conservative Republicans in every respect that to them mattered at the time.
Right.
And so I come from that geographically, culturally place, which is to say, I understand both the nightmarishness that has befallen the Republican Party, because I was aware of it being a decent thing, a decent conservative party for a while. And when I write a book like Evil Geniuses, I am to some degree writing to convince the people back home that, like, dudes, this is not fair. This is not – the system we have is not what you would have wanted, what you want. Let's just look at it rather than sticking to the tweets and talking points like, Democrats, they're socialists. Come on. And, yeah, that is my background. And I've been in New York for a long, long time, so I guess I'm a New Yorker now. But most of us, I think, lose where we came from.
No. Your home follows you wherever you go. What was so interesting about Evil Geniuses, and we're going to get to Facebook. We're also going to get to something that I've been obsessed about, and that is the super wealthy getting a free ride. But with Evil Geniuses, you talked about, for those who haven't read it, you really took us through the years on why the tax code went the way it went, the reason why antitrust legislation went the way it went when people followed Bork's thing. And I'll tell you, one great thing that reading the book did for me is realizing all of these groups that had supported me politically and it had been around me politically and all the people I supported, how actually there was a great variance. I sort of figured it out by 2008, because in 2008, when the big banks went, you know, almost went belly up and the economy went belly up, I was like, oh, shit. I voted. I thought I was voting for less regulation for banks. And I ended up, you know, helping wreck the economy with everybody else. The mistake that I made and a lot of other guys that had populist instincts made was going, you know, talking to our small business people who were having trouble with all the regulations and meeting payroll every 2 weeks. And I sort of projected that onto all businesses. And that was the huge mistake, I think, that not only I made and my class made with populists, but I think the whole conservative movement. And I don't know if they've still figured that out.
No, they haven't. And I refer to my, I tell my own mea culpa story as a Gary Hart Clintonian Democrat and realizing that they, in a lesser tiny degree, I had been played by the big business CEOs and the super rich to be their useful idiots.
Sort of the Bob Rubin Democrats. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yeah. I guess that's what I'm saying. And so you were a different kind of useful idiot, is what you're saying. And yeah, I mean, and
by the way, I still am a useful idiot for somebody. I don't know who, but I am for somebody.
We all are. Yeah. But no, it's that big business, small business distinction is so important. And in Evil Geniuses, I don't demonize business across the board. I am always careful to say big business. You know, business roundtable, CEOs of the 200 largest companies. It's a whole different thing than the person with a shop on Main Street.
Right.
You know, and deserve to be treated differently.
And those small businesses, I think Democrats and Republicans can fight to help the small businesses any way they can. The problem comes now, and I still see it with Democrats and Republicans, this fear of taxing capital. I mean, we conservatives, a former Republican, we always whined about income redistribution. Well, the most massive income redistribution in the history of mankind, womankind, whatever kind, has been from the middle class to the super wealthy.
Correct.
The middle class has shrunk, and their money has gone. You can just draw a straight line from the middle class to the trillions of dollars that have gone to the super wealthy.
Absolutely true. The last 30, 40 years. And it didn't just happen, right? I mean, that's what part of the point of this book is to, it doesn't just happen. I mean, certain things just happen. Technology happens. Globalization happens. Those are, and that affects every country in the world. But how you deal with those changes and how you cut the pie differently are a series of choices. They just are, which is why inequality of wealth and income has not skyrocketed in other developed countries like it has in the U.S. It has in the U.S. because those choices by the libertarian economic right were prevailed for several decades. And therefore, the pie was cut differently. And therefore, as you say, trillions and trillions of dollars were redistributed upward from the working and middle class.
This is what I don't understand. I remember 1986 hearing the story of the tax overhaul when they reformed the tax system, reformed the IRS code. It supposedly started when Don Regan went into Ronald Reagan and said, you know, your secretary has a higher tax rate than named five corporations. Reagan, of course, outraged. He said, do something about it. And we still have that system. I mean, you tell me, how in the hell are we in 2021 and Amazon paying 0% in tax, 0% in taxes. Nike paid 0% in taxes. Archer, Daniels,
Midland
paying zero. Not zero in taxes. I don't know how much Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates are paying or the richest billionaires in America, but probably 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%.
Yeah.
You know, I had one really rich guy say to me, he goes, you know what you need to do? I go, what's that? He goes, you need to make money, like capital gains. So you can pay like 15 or 16. I said, I get a paycheck across my desk every 2 weeks or wired into my bank account. You have to start with $1 billion to, you know, be able to cheat the system the way you're cheating the system.
You don't have to have a billion, though. You could be cheating it right now, Joe. But no, I mean, that's the thing is that, of course, everybody would like lower taxes, and that's the trick that the Reaganites pulled in the 80s, which is to say, don't you, teacher, lawyer, you know, cop, whatever, want lower taxes? Well, so do we for everybody. Well, so you lower it a little bit for those people, but it's a Trojan horse. As David Stockman admitted at the time, the director of the Office of Management Budget under Reagan in 1981, admitted, no, this is just a Trojan horse. It's all about getting the tax rates lower on corporations and rich people and getting the middle class rabble to go along. That's what it was, and that's what it remains. And then you have, you know, the right still saying today these same talking points that have been not proved out again and again and again, which is say, oh, we just, all we have to do is lower taxes and it will trickle down and there'll be jobs for everybody. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
I don't think that argument's working. And by the way, I just want people who are listening thinking that I'm talking about people who make $400,000 and more or more. No. I'm talking about billionaires.
Yes.
I'm talking about people like multimillionaires. I'm talking about the largest multinational corporations on the face of the earth who don't have to pay taxes.
Right.
We're all of us, suckers, because the wealthiest people on the planet are somehow able to get away with murder when it comes to not having to pay taxes.
Well, the other thing that we did at the same time are these things that nobody noticed. There was no big debate over lowering the minimum wage in 1980. It was just lowered because inflation effectively lowered. If you don't raise it, it gets lower and lower and lower. It goes from $12 effectively to $7. Overtime, same deal. You know, back in the day in the 70s, most working people got overtime if they worked over 40 hours. Now, a tiny percentage get overtime because you just lower the threshold. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, companies couldn't buy their own shares of their own stock to goose up the price. Right. That was just a little SEC regulatory change in 1982. Kaboom, that's how big corporations spend most of their money now, is buying their own stock. Thing after thing after thing, in addition to the tax.
And by the way, corporations buying their own stock, we said repeatedly on our show, before the Trump tax cuts, this isn't going to go back into the companies. They're not going to reinvest and build new factories or build new branch
R&D.
Offices, hire more people. This won't be for R&D. They will buy back their own stock. And then, guess what? When they all started buying back their own stock, people like Marco Rubio, I'm shocked. They bought back their own stock. Who could have ever seen that coming?
Yeah. And that is, ugh. I mean, it's amazing the degree to which literally most of them spend most of their earnings on that.
Yeah. And they made so much money. So Kurt, I want to move from one of my pet peeves to another one of my pet peeves. And that is, that's Facebook. And that's YouTube. And that's these big tech companies that are getting away with just the worst behavior, especially Facebook. I want to ask you something that I asked you on Morning Joe about the head of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. Have we had any one business leader in our country as unaccountable and as powerful as Mark Zuckerberg is right now?
You have to go back a century. You have to go back to the end of the robber barons when J.P. Morgan died, whenever that was, around 1920 or something. No, there hasn't been. And part of the reason there hasn't been, you haven't had the exact power because this is an information power. He controls the most important media information channel, portal, platform, call it what you will, other than Google. And he single-handedly controls it. It's not, there are millions of shareholders and there's a board, but it is this one guy. It is, as you're suggesting, it's like a thing that hasn't happened since the bad old days. And that's partly because of the new nature of this technology
right.
that didn't exist 20 years ago. But it's also because of the new nature of, government can't do anything. All regulation is bad. All government intervention in the marketplace is bad that started in 1980 and came into full fruition around 2000 when Mark Zuckerberg graduates college or doesn't graduate college and starts Facebook.
Right.
And so that's why it's been allowed to be happen. I mean, Facebook and Google could not have gotten to the level of unaccountable power that they've gotten in the 20th century. And ironically, what allowed Facebook and Google to grow into the colossi they have become, and I think it's colossuses, but to become these giant,
like Colossi, that.
giant companies is the last great federal antitrust action was against Microsoft back in the late 90s that scared them from out of the internet space as it was intended to do and allowed Google and Facebook not to be crushed by Microsoft.
Right.
But that was then, now we're done with antitrust, and so we'll let them do whatever the hell they want. And that's what they've gotten away with. And Congress is still catching up to even figure out what they are, let alone how to stop them from doing the bad things they do.
Yeah. You know, what's so crazy about that is that when I've given speeches over the past 10, 15, 20 years, I've always talked about how we as a country make so many mistakes. And yes, we're crazy at times, but we're the right kind of crazy. And I talk about Steve Jobs' Think Different ad, which actually the first time I saw it stopped me in my tracks. I said, I always gave the example of the reason why Japan never could catch us, why China will never catch us, is because a bunch of Berkeley potheads could borrow $5,000, go into Bill Gates' father's garage in Seattle, and start Microsoft. To me, that is the greatness of America. When I'm flying over cities, I'm looking down and I just see the patchwork of neighborhoods. It's something I just can't even comprehend how we do what we do. But I know it starts in garages, like Bill Gates' garage, and what he was able to do with his Berkeley friends, and they started a corporation that changed the world. Now, ironically, that corporation is a monopoly,
right,
in its own sense, and that's stopping other Bill Gates in 2021 from doing what he did, just like Zuckerberg is stopping other Zuckerbergs that are coming out of college now from doing what Zuckerberg did.
Totally. And, you know, the thing is, economies and economic systems are not like nature, where they just grow and they do their own thing. They are, from the get-go, as long as we and all of our great-grandparents have been alive, they are designed, those systems are designed and managed by the state in one form or another. So that's what has to happen. And back to the nature metaphor, these mighty oaks, some of them like Microsoft or Google or Facebook grow, and you got to forest them. You got to cut them down sometimes. You got to cut them into bits and replant them.
We did it with the bells.
We did it amazingly well with the bells, right, over a long period of time. I mean, there was one phone company, kids.
Right. We got cell phones now because we did it to the bells.
We have a computer industry, thanks to what they started doing with the bell, with Ma Bell in the 50s, to allow the semiconductor industry not to be a Western Electric AT&T monopoly. So the history is so clear that this is good for the system, for ultimately for Wall Street, for creating wealth. Like, you know, again, turn these two big trees into 100 beautiful new blooms. And that's how it worked in the past. And that's, again, however you end up dealing with Google and Facebook, breaking them up and otherwise, it will not destroy wealth. And I do not believe it will destroy meaningful innovation. It will do what happened, as you say, with AT&T and Ma Bell becoming all the baby bells and allowing our current computer industry to flourish.
Now, we may have ideological differences. I'm not exactly sure where they are now. Since
we can find them.
Since it's become a fight between liberal democracy and illiberal democracy, everything else sort of seems like details. But let me just take a jab at it.
Sure.
I probably am more of a disciple of sort of Hayek and the free market. I love the free market.
Yeah.
I believe in the free market.
Yeah.
I believe when I'm flying over these communities that no man or woman could have ever imagined that. It is the free market, and it's people that, you know, the friction rubbing off of you. But here's the deal. What's happening right now in the American economy is actually, you talk about those big oaks, it's strangling the free market. It's strangling free enterprise. It's strangling access to capital. It's strangling access to innovation for small business owners, for entrepreneurs, for the most creative people in our society. So if somebody's sitting here listening, going, oh, Kurt Anderson and Joe Scarborough, they want to chop up corporations because they're socialists. This is Great Britain 1969. Fuck off. You're wrong. I actually want more. I want more small businesses. I want more technology companies. I want more innovation. I want more freedom. And maybe that's why, Kurt, maybe that's why even some Republicans that have done some deplorable fucking things over the past 6 months to a year are actually saying the same thing that you and I are saying.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, yes, you are born into the faith of Hayek, Friedman, Reaganism, so you will probably always have that more than I. But I am, like one of my heroines, Elizabeth Warren, a believer in the free market. It's proven itself to be incredibly efficient. But the thing is, it's not this extreme American version of capitalism, the free market, versus Venezuelan Soviet communism. Those aren't the choices.
Those aren't our choices.
You know,
exactly.
Look at, for instance, the wonderful little Nordic countries who are judged by the conservative groups who judge these things to be among the freest free market economies in the world, in some cases freer than the U.S. economy. And they have these giant welfare states. So are they socialists? No, they are free market economies that have giant welfare states. And again, if you look back, as I just ask people to look back at the history, was 1945 to 1975 in economic terms, apart from racial inequities and gender inequities and the rest, was that a pretty good time? Yeah, and amazing growth and amazing fairness. We also had really high incomes on corporations and rich people. You know, so let's not make this stupid binary thing of it's Venezuela or it's America like we have it. If that's our choice, count me out.
Yeah, there is. We're talking to Kurt Anderson, author of Evil Geniuses, and most importantly, the man who brought Spy to the world. And so Josh Hawley is actually somebody that's talking about going after Facebook and going after these. They're just monopolies. And by the way, I was talking to, I won't say his name, but I was talking to a well-known friend of mine, and he invests in the stock market. He's like a really wealthy wheeler-dealer type guy. And he said, you need to get in the stock market. I said, I don't do stocks. I might as well go to the dog track. I don't trust Wall Street. I don't do any of it.
Huh.
He goes, just invest in the monopolies. I go, they're monopolies? He goes, they're monopolies. He goes, I'm going to give you four monopolies. You invest in them. They'll never go down, Joe. And he said, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and I don't know what the fourth one
Netflix,
is.
Netflix, maybe?
Salesforce, something. But he gave me the four monopolies, and so I invested a little bit of money for the first time ever. And he's right. They just go up. But but how crazy that you can say invest in the monopolies, and everybody's going to know who you're talking about.
Well, and that in this century, really, I mean, you know, that the idea of becoming a monopoly or part of a small oligopoly has become that brazenly, that's what we want to do. That wasn't allowed. I mean, that was not the American way. I mean, people like Dwight Eisenhower would brag about how tough and effective their antitrust breaking up company policies were, because that's what we did. Because for all the reasons you've said, no, the fact that that is now the thing that used to be not said is now said, at least from your rich friend to your ears, is amazing. And it won't end well. It won't end well.
And by the way, if my rich friend were in front of a room of 1,000 business owners and said, just invest in the monopolies, all the business owners would know who he was talking about.
Yes, yes.
And that's a crazy thing. And again, for those who might be thinking that people like you and me, and in this case, Josh Hawley, are left-wing radicals, the fact is, Alan Greenspan a couple of years ago said the greatest threat to American capitalism is income inequity.
Exactly. Well, and he had some strange ways he wanted to solve that problem,
right,
like, you know, keeping everybody's wages low so that the middle class wouldn't be jealous of the working class. But back to, you know, one of your current or former heroes, Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman said for years and years, when antitrust was effectual and vibrant in this country, that's one of the only things, that's about the only thing I believe in terms of government intervention in the marketplace that's a good thing. To your point, like, because competition is the beauty of this system. And then he backed off. Once his side defeated effective antitrust enforcement, he backed off that and decided, no, I don't like it either, and showed that he was a person of bad faith. But, part of the terrible thing about socialism and communism, of course, is that there's only one entity providing all your cars or all your anything.
Well, exactly.
Well, like, how about all your information?
Right. And that's what we've moved to. Can you just explain really quickly, for those who haven't read Evil Geniuses yet, because we're talking about antitrust laws, can you explain the Bork test and how that's changed everything?
Yeah, it was a thing I knew almost nothing about. So Robert Bork, who got famous for being dinged, not being confirmed as a Supreme Court justice when Ronald Reagan nominated him to be on the Supreme Court for racist things he'd done a few years earlier. But his big legacy is in the antitrust world. He was an antitrust expert at Yale Law School and wrote this book called The Antitrust Paradox that was published in 1978 that just changed single-handedly this whole incredibly important area of jurisprudence, more than, I don't know, any book short of Adam Smith has ever changed the economic consensus. So antitrust invented in the United States when big corporations came along a century earlier, late 19th century. It was always about restraining their economic power so that competition could flourish in the free market and constraining their political power and their excessive power, however that came to be defined. Robert Bork, after years of working in the Milton Friedman-esque trenches, summarized in this very lucid book, because he was a great writer, that no, corporate power is only a problem economically if it makes prices higher for consumers. Otherwise, anything goes. It used to be, before Bork, antitrust and all those kinds of economic regulations were construed more broadly. So suddenly it was, nope, if prices don't go up in a clear way where they fixed prices somehow, or then it's all good. Well, that effectively, immediately, that became the law of the land.
That's the test. So the test now has to do with the price tag.
To consumers,
right. But what that leaves out, obviously, is the thing I'm most worried about, the thing that free marketeers should be most worried about, and that is the ability to start a business and get into the marketplace.
Right. Because if you're in anywhere basically trying to start an internet business, your investors look at it and go, well, is Facebook or Google going to crush you, or are they going to acquire you? One or the other, those are the only choices.
Right.
Literally, that is how Silicon Valley looks at.
And conservatives listening need to understand, this test crushes competition. It is the antithesis.
Well, and you've got this
of what Hayek said that we needed.
And because the dirty, wonderful trick, wonderful if you're Mark Zuckerberg or Google, is we're not selling anything to consumers. It's all free to consumers. So that really is this giant loophole for getting around this Borkian redefinition of antitrust. Right. No, we're not. No, what do you mean? We're not selling anything. Well, we now control the advertising industry, so that's a monopoly where people are paying more money, and obviously consumers are paying more money because advertisers are paying more money, and so on and so forth.
And of course, the great line, I don't know if Steve Jobs said it, I'm not sure who said it, but if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. So yeah, it's not free. No. Yeah, no, you say, boy, I sure do like how that banana looks, and you get ads on your phone for the next 3 months about bananas.
And as I talk about Evil Geniuses, I encourage people to look at the prices for, say, telephone service, internet service, all these basics in the United States versus Europe. Europe, the great socialist Europe, who liberalized in the libertarian sense, you know, 25 years ago and stopped having nationalized companies and let the internet be real free markets and be properly regulated. As a result, they have a set of freer markets in those basic things than we do.
Yeah.
Because we have these monopolies keeping up by various means, keeping up prices.
So Kurt, let me ask if you're optimistic about where we're going. You unfortunately, me fortunately. You unfortunately have lived through 40 years of Republicans pretty much having their way, conservatives pretty much having their way. It's not gotten us to a great place in many ways. I mean, you look at our GDP keeps going up. Our economy's been doing well, but we've had a couple of crashes along the way, 2008 and obviously this past year. But a lot of people being left behind and the rich getting a hell of a lot richer. But what about the next 40 years? Do you believe, because I believe the Reagan era has ended. I think people don't believe that raising any tax is an attack against all Americans. And I do believe there's a growing skepticism about these monopolies, about these multinational corporations that are paying zero in taxes.
I don't know that it's over, but it looks like, blessedly, it's ending, and that the long New Deal era from, let's say, 1933 to 1980, 45 plus years. Now we're almost 45 plus years. So maybe there is something to these cycles, and they last right. a certain length of time, and we are ending. And all of what you say is true.
We had FDR for 40 years, Reagan for 40 years.
Something like that.
Yeah, something like
that. But, you know, your former party, and, mm-hmm. and whenever they talk about economics, their talking points are no different than they were in 1983 mm-hmm. before the wreckage was created right. by those policies. So, you know, and here and there, the people less deplorable than Josh Hawley on the right are saying certain things about what economic fairness would look like from a conservative point mm-hmm. of view. So, yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. Certainly, the Biden administration makes me very hopeful about, you know, where the Democratic Party has come to this, you know, in terms of the people that he's put in charge of antitrust at the Department of Justice, at the Federal Trade Commission, and elsewhere, and his basic policies of, you know, a new deal, you know, of trying to help parents and trying to help people work and, you know, trying to make housing more affordable. All those things Franklin Roosevelt talked about in his new economic Bill of Rights in 1944, mm-hmm. right? Well, maybe the Republicans will come along. Maybe the right will come along. But I agree with you that the basic belief that you need, you know, you can't have any government intervention in the marketplace and everybody can just make it on their own, I think more and more people don't buy that anymore. And frankly, I tell people if you see a future for the right, look at Donald Trump's final big 2-minute ad when he ran for president in 2016. Could have been a Bernie Sanders ad. I'm telling you, the voiceover.
I said it on the air. I think, or maybe I tweeted it, and I think it was a Steve Bannon ad. At least Steve Bannon took credit for that. Yeah. He's also, of course, taken credit for, like, you know, winning World War II and everything. Yeah. He takes credit for everything. But I saw that 2-minute ad, and I said, "That's a guy who's probably going to win."
Yeah,
because just like Elizabeth Warren, just like Bernie Sanders. It was about how the process was rigged for the richest
Correct.
Americans. And for the life of me, there are a lot of things. I knew Donald for 10 years beforehand. And I saw him in groups of people where he'd be a very charming person. I know you guys yes. documented Spy. Were you actually the one that came up with short-fingered Vulgarian?
Well, Grady and I together.
It's just horrible. First time I saw it, I said,
Well, it's
God,
just empirically true.
It is just And he goes into his Washington Post editorial meeting in April or May of 2016. And all he's talking about is his big, beautiful hands, because what you did back in the 1990s. So I've actually forgotten what I was going to
Donald Trump's socialism.
Yeah, Donald Trump. So one of the things that surprised me about Donald Trump is the fact that he was as stupid as he was to not use the charm that he's capable of using to get Nancy Pelosi and other people together. Because, listen, the great lie is that Donald Trump gives a damn about anybody who's not in power. Like, Nancy Pelosi, that's like his people. He likes Nancy Pelosi. He doesn't get people like Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan. He has contempt for those people. He's got contempt for evangelicals. He's a New York guy who's always had contempt for people in flyover space. So that was one surprise. The second surprise, getting back to this ad, that 2-minute ad, I thought, oh my God, anybody that runs with this, especially from the Republican Party. That's somebody who's going to have 60% approval ratings. But he got in. He immediately went the opposite direction. Not that that shocks me. I'm just saying the stupidity of it.
Totally.
If you wanted to get reelected, just try to enact what you were talking about in that ad.
No, exactly. And if he'd governed half of as he'd run, I'm going to give you the best medical care. It's going to be better and cheaper. I'm going to go after rich people on Wall Street. I'm going to do the trillion-dollar infrastructure. Actually try to do any of those, he would be president today.
No, no doubt.
You know?
Well, it's a big surprise. All right. So any final thoughts?
No, I mean, you know, I mean, on all this stuff we've talked about, I am, you know, I mean, even as just, you know, several steps ahead, there's an abyss of doom always lately. You know,
Do you think there's an abyss of doom?
Well, we don't have to go into it. I think we can avoid. I'm still hopeful.
So I'm married to Democrat. All right.
We turned back from the abyss of doom.
So help me out here. I married a Democrat.
Yeah. And then became one.
No, I haven't become one yet.
That's what you say.
But the thing is, she's very pessimistic.
Yeah.
And I talked to Democrats, and a lot of them seem to be very pessimistic. Yeah. And it's kind of like, oh, we don't deserve nice things. You know, I guess I'm still a conservative at heart because I said, I don't give a damn if I deserve nice things or not. I'm going to get it. If I'm running, I'm going to win. And things are going to be better. Tomorrow's another day.
Yeah.
You know, boats beating back against the tides and all that stuff. I want to know, like, why can't Democrats be both more optimistic, one, and two, when they run in political campaigns, why can't they be singularly focused on turning their opponents' political bones to dust and destroying them and winning so much by such a large margin that even their dog will be ashamed to walk down the street with them? Why can't they do that, Kurt?
Well,
why can't they? They need to do that to save Western civilization.
I agree with you on those.
So what is it? Is it DNA? What is it?
Well, there's a certain fraction of people on the left who are, and especially younger ones, who are have a serious either earnest belief in or flirtation with the apocalypse, and that it's bad, and we cannot fix climate change, and we're going to lose democracy.
Can't do anything. Exactly.
And you know, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, but they also, younger people in particular, have only lived. People under 45 have only lived in this fucked up, evil genius taken over America. So why should they have hope?
Well,
I lived in a time when things were economically fair. I lived in a time as a baby when the interstate highway system and the space program happened. They haven't seen that.
Anything was possible.
Correct.
So you go back and you look, and you can go year by year by year by year by year. And I had 2000 to 2015 down before COVID, and I stopped giving speeches. But 2000, the recount. How crazy was that? The Supreme Court decides 5-4 on party lines who becomes the next president of the United States, and the next president that becomes president of the United States, of course, doesn't win the majority of the vote. 2001, we got the tax. 2002, Enron, MCI. 2003, we've got the Iraq War. 2004, we've got Katrina. 2005, you just go year by year by year by year. There was one disaster after another that would make Americans think, I can't trust my government to be competent. I can't. And then you go all the way up to 2008 and sort of crescendoed there.
No, that's the problem. And for those in the political sphere who part of whose project is to make people disbelieve in the competence of government,
right,
it was a win-win. Right? Like, we're gonna underfund public goods and public services so they'll be shitty. And then we'll be able to say, look, government doesn't do anything for you. And we should keep government out of everything. So yeah. And then there's these unforced errors like, you know, the wars that just didn't need to happen at the scale they happened. Right. Again, that's a whole different subject of American hubris and people not having learned the lessons of the war of my childhood.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have not lost hope. I was prepared to lose all hope last November and by 45,000 votes in scattered around America, I didn't. So
I was prepared to move to New Zealand.
Yeah, is that your place?
No, actually, it was going to be. I thought Vancouver, maybe.
Yeah, Portugal. One of my daughters. Portugal is one of those countries that has the golden visa. You just buy a house, not that of expensive a house, and you're good.
And by the way, may I recommend to all the people that think the storming of the Capitol was cool, and just want to talk about how bad America is and how American democracy. There's a bumper sticker that I saw in my parents' neighborhood all the time in the late 1960s, early 1970s. America, love it or leave it. They can get the hell out if they want to. And by the way, I think Democrats should start saying that. America, love it or leave it. Really, you don't have faith in American democracy? Right. Really, you think it's rigged? I've got friends I've known for 50 years that have believed in America, have believed in the system, have been the flag wavers, have been saying the support the troopers, all this other. Suddenly, their guy doesn't win. And suddenly American democracy doesn't work. Suddenly everything is corrupt.
Yep.
Suddenly they're justifying, but not really justifying, but they're justifying the attacks on the Capitol on January the 6th. I say, Kurt, America, love it or leave it, right?
So you're not going to New Zealand, I'm not going to Portugal.
No, I would have stayed here regardless. Yeah. Saturday. Kurt Anderson, thank you so much, and I greatly appreciate it.
Total fun, and the beauty of audio, of course, is that we can just yammer on and on.
I can talk forever.
No one telling us to stop.
Alex isn't yelling at me. I mean, I really wanted to get into your favorite bands because you grew up in a pretty incredible time.
Next time.
All right, Kurt Anderson, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been great having you here. And by the way, Kurt's book, Evil Geniuses, is now out in paperback. We appreciate, as always, you being with us. This is the Joe Scarborough Podcast. I'll be talking to you soon.